Thank you for listening to another episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, maps of the airfield, mission breakdowns, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content. They may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Billy? Billy? A familiar voice called out Beans' name from what seemed like an adjacent room. His eyes flickered open, only to be met with the shock of finding himself lying on his bed back home. In a state of perplexity, he scanned the room, trying to make sense of the sudden change. Slowly rising from his bed, Beans stood up and immediately noticed the stark difference in his attire. Instead of his flight clothes, he was clad in his favorite red plaid shirt and soft khaki pants, reminiscent of the Christmas before he enlisted. Running a hand through his hair, he was taken aback to discover it was styled in a short, tight come-over with the side part, a style that he had not worn since joining the military. The dissonance between his surroundings and the uniform he remembered wearing moments ago in the aircraft left him bewildered, grappling with the inescapable shift from the fortress of misery to the familiar comfort of his past life. Bean seized the moment to absorb his surroundings, meticulously examining every detail of the room. During sleepless nights in basic, and particularly in England, he'd often tried to conjure a mental image of this space as a soothing method to lull himself into sleep. The act of vividly visualizing a familiar and comforting place had been the fastest route to tranquility. Now, finding himself standing in that very room once more, an almost mysterious sensation washed over his psyche. The surreal experience of being physically present in the haven he'd so often crafted in his mind left him in a state of introspective wonder. Interrupting the nostalgic moment, Beans' mother burst into the room, her expression fraught with frustration. With a hand on her hip, she exclaimed, "Billy, I've been calling for you. Where on earth have you disappeared to?" Initially, overwhelmed by his mother's reprimand, Beans found himself grappling with a wave of emotions upon seeing her face. "Billy, answer me. Where have you been?" she pressed, her tone a mixture of concern and urgency. Struggling to speak through the welling tears, Beans managed, "I've been away, Ma." Despite his efforts to contain himself, a surge of emotions overwhelmed him. His lips quivered, tears welled up in his eyes, and he continued, "I'm sorry for leaving." Beans watched as his mother's expression shifted from one of frustration to concern, then to profound relief, registering the weight of his words. Beans' mother hurried towards him, enveloping him in a tight embrace. As her arms encircled him, Beans melted into her warmth, finding solace in the familiar embrace. Nestling his face against her shoulder, he inhaled deeply, capturing the welcoming and comforting fragrance that had been absent for so long, a sentimental and nostalgic scent that he had come to accept that he'd never get to experience again. As Beans baked in the warmth of the embrace, a bitter transformation began. His mother's comforting scent turned harsh, a mixture of stale sweat and pungent odors, oil, aviation fuel, cordite, gunpowder, and fear. The once warm embrace turned cold, devoid of life in its presence. When Beans attempted to release himself from his mother's hold, he felt as though he passed right through her, her frame still and ethereal like a ghost. Amidst the haunting scene, the air filled with a thunderous sound of flak. Looking down, Beans found himself back in his flight attire. Gazing upward, he witnessed his mother's frozen, translucent form fading away, evoking a torrent of horror, sorrow, isolation, and despair. Overwhelmed by these emotions, Beans was compelled to lie back down on his bed, the weight of his flak vest pressing against him. Succumbing almost against his will, he closed his eyes, bidding farewell to this cruel illusion of home. Less than a minute later, May 25th, 1944, 23,000 feet above Bordeaux, France, 11:46. Being stirred to the chaotic symphony of exploding flak, his eyes fluttering open to find himself seated below his gunner's opening. Nearby, Mills struggled to regain his footing, prompting Muth to lend assistance while eyeing Beans with concern. Amidst the tumultuous scene, Beans grappled with a foggy mind, finding it arduous to grasp the situation or stirring coherent thoughts together. Confusion enveloped his senses as he tried to make sense of the unfolding chaos and understand the sequence of events. Once Mills was finally steadied on his feet, Beans realized that he and Mills were connected to their rechargeable portable oxygen bottles. Upon this discovery, Beans' gaze fell upon their connected oxygen lines, noticing Willie inspecting them in the radio room. In a fleeting moment of clarity, the realization struck him like a lightning bolt. The oxygen line had faltered and suffered damage, leading both to him and Mills to experience hypoxia due to oxygen deprivation. However, a surge of concern followed. If he and Mills were affected, what about Tommy or Marshy? The gravity of the situation began to sink as Beans struggled with the potential implications of their compromised oxygen supply. Struggling to rise, Muth hurried over to assist Beans, who pulled his oxygen mask down to inquire about their predicament. Muth's swift response detailed the situation. During the recent fighter attack, a bullet had damaged the primary oxygen line supplying the waste compartment of the aircraft. Beans listened intensely as Muth explained that Tommy and Marshy hadn't yet been affected, suggesting that the increased physical activity led to their faster oxygen depletion compared to the more stationary positions of Tommy and Marshy. Mid-explanation, a voice cracked over the intercom.
Navigator to pilot, we're at the IP. Proceed on this heading.
Jack swiftly took charge, activating the autopilot and handing controls to Tarnaski, announcing that they were now in fact on the bomb run. With a sense of urgency, Muth hurried back to his radio room, likely aiding Willie in attempting to repair the damaged line using whatever tools were available. The dire situation propelled them to swift action as they worked against the odds to rectify the oxygen supply issue before it escalated further. In the cockpit, Jack and Beck observed the synchronization actions of the bombers ahead. As the planes in the leading group and those flying above them began to open their bomb bay doors, Tarnaski, following a well-practiced routine, mirrored their movements. The sequence unfolded with a precision that spoke volumes to the rehearsed nature of their maneuvers, each action a critical step in the coordination of a bombing run. In the radio room, Willie meticulously finished repairing the damaged oxygen line, with Muth providing assistance. The increasing intensity of flak prompted Muth to document a downed fortress on his desk. Just as Muth marked the incident, a sudden explosion shook the Bull's radio compartment. Willie and Muth were thrown to the floor, with Willie swiftly getting back up on his feet, assessing the damage. To his relief, the radio compartment appeared unharmed. He checked on Muth, confirming his well-being. Plugged into the audio line, Muth reported to Jack about the intact radio room, stating that Willie would soon inspect the exterior. Willie gave a thumbs up after a quick check, signaling that no damage was done from the blast. Muth, overhearing a distress call from a damaged B-17, relayed the information to Jack. Marshy's report confirmed the B-17 was from the 531st Squadron.
10 seconds to target.
Tarnaski's voice came over the intercom. Beans, gripping his gunner station, observed the unfolding aerial chaos. Hailing Mary, which was flying off the Bull's 3 o'clock position, looked to be damaged and drifting, raising concern. Just as he was about to report the situation, Beans heard the announcement of the bomb's release. Fixated on Hailing Mary, Beans witnessed a tragic sequence. A stream of bombs released by another B-17 flying in the lead group was heading down towards Hailing Mary. One bomb struck the outboard starboard engine, tearing it off, followed by another one, hitting the remaining section of the wing. A massive fireball engulfed the doomed bomber. Beans, horrified, found himself in a perplexed state. It was Tommy who managed to call it in first, expressing shock.
Man, Hailing!
What?
Jack demanded, distressed.
Hailing's gone!
Beans replied.
Yeah, I don't know what the fuck happened!
Tommy inquired.
Bomb fell on it!
Beans muttered.
Shits?
Beck asked urgently.
I doubt it.
Tommy commented.
Well, check it, goddammit!
Jack scolded. The boss anxiously occupied his desk inside his meticulously painted office. The rich aroma of mahogany furniture and cigarette smoke filled the room. The ticking of an antique clock on the wall seemed to echo the passing seconds, each tick amplifying the tension that hung in the air. Glancing at his wristwatch, adorned with a worn leather strap, he noticed the time. 11:50. An uneasy amalgamation of anxiety and boredom continued to pervade the room, the air heavy with anticipation. The boss, accurately aware of the silent minutes dragging on, felt the urgent need to stave off the encroaching unease before it took full command over his mind. Standing up, the boss proceeded to walk out of his office and head to the control tower. Entering the bustling control room, the boss scanned the room for updates, his presence immediately capturing the attention of the personnel within. Surprisingly, Colonel Poole stood just beyond the perimeter walkway, responding to the boss's arrival with a swift entrance. As someone prepared to address the boss's inquiry, Colonel Poole spoke up, his authoritative voice cutting through the ambient hum of activity.
Everything has seemed to play out just as we were expecting. Formation passed over the primary target, executing their mock bomb run, and then the group ran down the western coast of France, skipping over the secondary target, and last we heard, the formation was minutes away from the IEP. We're still waiting to hear more.
Curiosity etched on his features, the boss inquired further.
And what about the escorts? They did as they were supposed to do. They reported a total of 5 kills with only 1 loss. I say that is a good exchange. And we have the return escorts on their way to meet up with the formation as we speak. They should meet up with the group just after the rally.
Good.
the boss murmured, his gaze drifting into the distance, his mind absorbing and processing the unfolding information. Approaching the designated rally point, the formation soared 25,000 feet above the picturesque French town of Limbourne. Despite the imminent return, the skies were still fraught with flak, its accuracy and intensity ebbing and flowing like an unpredictable tide. Regrettably, the absence of parachutes from Hailing Mary cast a somber shadow over the men of Loaded Bull. Since the release of the bombs, two more B-17s from Abel and Baker Group had succumbed to the perils of the mission, and three fortresses lagged behind due to battle damage. With precision, Willie successfully completed the arduous task of patching the damaged oxygen line. As he meticulously secured a final component of his repair, a sense of relief permeated the air. Returning to his designated position, Willie observed the men stationed at the waste compartment, conducting a series of checks on their oxygen meters. In the nose of the aircraft, Reinhold meticulously studied his flight map, endeavoring to anticipate the course of the return journey, his focus centered on the charting of the path that mirrored their earlier trajectory along with the western coasts of France, mapping out the many details of their upcoming flight. That's when a bewildering and alarming call echoed over the group channel, leaving Reinhold perplexed and gravely concerned. The command was to change the formation's heading at the rally point, not to the northwest as expected, but to the northeast, steering the formation deeper into France instead of towards the western coast. A 120-mile flight to the next waypoint awaited them from this new direction. Swiftly informing Jack of the altered course, Reinhold meticulously mapped out their trajectory. He realized the next waypoint was over the heavily fortified city of Poitiers, surrounding by a formidable flak batteries and air defenses, giving its location 100 miles inland. While hoping for a western turn after reaching Poitiers, Reinhold, considering fuel consumption, feared that the formation might have to navigate through the heart of France, proceeding up through the Normandy coast for the return to England. As these thoughts consumed Reinhold, an announcement echoed through the aircraft. A large formation of incoming planes was approaching from the 1 o'clock position. In a panic, Jack ordered everyone to their guns, and the crew swiftly complied. However, as the unidentified aircraft drew nearer, relief swept through the crew upon the realization that they were friendly escorts. Yet, once that relief subsided, Jack couldn't shake the nagging question. Why weren't these the escorts that they had before? The abrupt change in the bomber's target and the limited fuel capacity of the fighters returning home failed to explain the timely arrival of these escorts at the rally point.
Hey, what's up, y'all? You want something new to listen to? Well, let me introduce you to the Deep Dive Podcast, the podcast where two best friends come together and review the latest TV shows and movies, everything from anime, action, to sci-fi thrillers. If you click the link tree in our bio, it'll take you to all of our social media pages, including our Spotify, where every Monday, me, Miles, and my other co-host, Seth, will be bringing you a new episode. So grab a drink, grab a snack, come join us. And let's dive in.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast.
It had been 14 minutes since the escorts arrived at the formation, revealing themselves to be 10 squadrons of P-51s, totaling about 40 in number. The formation found itself approximately 10 miles southwest of the French city of Angoulême, coincidentally the location of their secondary target. The crew of Lhota Bol, particularly Beck, couldn't help but find the irony in the situation. As Beck observed the clear skies above Angoulême, he remarked,
"That's funny. Not a single cloud near or above Angoulême, whatever the fuck this place is called. I was just thinking the same thing. What, you think it's bad intelligence?"
inquired Tarnaski.
"The army? Bad intelligence? No way. You sound silly suggesting that the army would do something wrong."
Just as Beck finished, a solitary flak shell burst near Able Group's wing, prompting Jack to order everyone don their flak jackets and helmets. As Jack issued the command, the flak grew in intensity. As the formation soared past Angoulême, Beck, fleeting a surge of defiance, raised his middle finger towards the fortified city. Jack, catching this act of rebellion, couldn't help but chuckle before announcing the need to check oxygen meters. Merely 3 minutes later, the flak diminished significantly, prompting Willie to say,
"Phew, so glad we avoided that by bombing Bordeaux, whatever the fuck we just bombed. Yeah, no kidding. Berlin thinks it's got flak batteries,"
added Tommy.
"Don't you fucking jinx us, Tommy, I swear to Christ almighty,"
Mills interjected.
"Bandits spotted, 2 o'clock low,"
blared a voice over the group channel.
"Tommy, you son of a bitch,"
Marshy exclaimed.
"Enough chatter, man, can anyone spot them? How many are there?"
Jack inquired, attempting to catch a glimpse himself alongside Beck.
"I don't, but escorts are heading there, though,"
Beans observed as he watched the eager fighters dive down to confront the incoming threat. Over the next few minutes, Tarnaski in the nose observed and relayed the skirmish ensuing between the incoming fighters and the escorts. However, Marshy's intercom announcement cut through with alarming news.
"Guys, we got more bandits coming in 6 o'clock high. Jesus, I'm coming."
From Marshy's vantage point, he witnessed around 24 German 109s hurling in from the 6 o'clock position, launching their assaults on the groups trailing behind Baker Group. As Marshy reported their rear attacks, Tarnaski notified that some fighters, reportedly about a dozen FW-190s, had breached the escort attacks, aiming for the bomber formation. However, before they could reach Able or Baker Group, escorts trailed behind, firing shots that the nimble fighters skillfully evaded. Over the ensuing 3 minutes, the Bull's crew watched the relentless attempts of the fighters to attack the bombers in Able Group or the groups behind Baker Group. Despite the attacks staying beyond firing range of the 300th, an uneasy silence prevailed over the intercom. A lone 190 circled and directed cannon rounds towards the bombers in Able Group, evading incoming fire before launching 3 bursts towards the 300th. All missing the formation by a significant margin. The crew of the Bull, grappled by tension, observed the skirmishes as though they were watching a college football game. The swift attacks by the overwhelming number of escorts created a spectacle. Soon, a 109 made a pass at the bombers in Baker Group, initially engaging a B-17 before targeting Bomb McGee, which was flying without a wingman. Beans alerted the crew about the incoming fighter, firing upon it. However, a P-51 swooped in, maneuvering amidst the bombers, and delivered 3 precise bursts, engulfing the enemy fighter in flames. As the remaining German fighters ceased their attacks and retreated, Tarnaski questioned,
"Is that it? I didn't even get to fire my guns, what a joke."
Willie's sarcastic comment punctured the tense atmosphere aboard the Bull.
"There may be more, fellas. Keep your eyes peeled and the intercom clear,"
Jack commanded. The boss had shifted from his position in the control tower, now pacing anxiously between the tower and a parked deuce and a half. Suddenly, Plank emerged with his hands in his pockets, observing the situation. As he approached the boss, he remarked,
"I saw smoke. Thought there was a fire. But looks like you're just overthinking with that brain of yours."
Lifting his head to meet Plank's gaze, the boss managed an awkward,
"Hey, Plank,"
before his face fell again and he resumed his brisk pacing.
"If you're going to keep this up, you're going to wear that grass down to the topsoil. Grounds are going to promote you to mowing duty. You'll have to do grid walks to keep the grass down,"
Plank teased, provoking a subtle chuckle from the boss.
"Probably a better occupation than what we're doing. A lot less stress, I imagine,"
Plank commented. The boss stopped, looked up at Plank, and despite attempting eye contact, the personal moment made it uncomfortable, so he broke eye contact but continued.
"This is what I wanted, Plank. From the moment I saw that plane fly overhead, I wanted this. I wanted to start a new life, a new career, and have some stability after losing my stability."
"What are you talking about? You joined the military, Bacchus. If you were looking for stability, then you're about as sharp as a marble, my friend,"
Plank retorted.
"Not as in location or day-to-day stability, I mean security. Finding my place in the world. I tried the traditional path, and God made it clear that I was wrong for traveling down that path, so I went down a different path, but I still feel like this wasn't the right one either. Why?"
Plank listened intensely, and after an awkward pause, he finally spoke up, asking,
"What did you think that you were going to be doing? I don't quite understand what's going on inside that thick skull of yours, Bacchus. You're a squadron commander. You're commanding a squadron of men and planes who sometimes come back and other times don't. That's the job. That's what has always been the job. Lying wasn't a part of that job,"
the boss fired back.
"What's lying got to do with it? What happened today wasn't a lie. It's called..."
At this point, both Plank and the boss realized their volume might attract unwanted attention. Plank lowered his voice and stepped closer to the boss before finishing,
"I call it strategy. The P-38s wouldn't have been able to take down as many as they did if we didn't let Germany know that the bombers were going to be where they were going to be. Not to mention, sending them to Bordeaux was no different than if they had gone to their first fake target, or second target. Plank, it's the whole thing. Telling the airmen that they were going to go back to the coast when we knew the whole time that they were going to be a worm on a hook as they were dragged through the center of France hoping that the fish would come up to bite. That is what I'm saying is not right,"
the boss asserted.
"Bacchus, you know that morale is at an all-time low. How do you think that would have gone over with them? What are you so worried about? This wasn't your plan. This was the brass's plan. Besides, we weren't even supposed to know. At least, I'm guessing we weren't by the way that Colonel Poole acted,"
Plank reasoned.
"What if it backfires?" the boss asked. "How could this backfire? Are you afraid people are going to hold you responsible like they did after Brunswick?"
Plank inquired. After the boss didn't respond, Plank continued.
"It is, isn't it? Bacchus, not everything is about you. We've got a war to win. And this is how it gets done."
The formation was now approaching their waypoint, positioned over the fortified city of Poignet, France. Jack prepared the group for yet another venture through a flak field, anticipating the order to head northeast until they reached their next waypoint, situated over the French town of Lavelle. Due to the imminent flak fields, the escorts prudently maintained their distance until the group moved beyond the range of the city's flak guns. Willie, scanning the skies from his top turret, observed the escort's departure. Soon, the ominous sound of flak erupted.
"Flak low, clock low. Let's hope these shows are horrible shots,"
Willie's voice announced over the intercom. Over the next few minutes, the flak intensified, with the majority of the bursts clustering around Able Group.
Tarnaski and Beck reported two more downed B-17s, one succumbing to a direct hit and the other due to engine failure. In the radio room, Muth manned his gun, watching black puffs float by through his gunner's opening. To say Muth was nervous was an understatement. His brow was soaked in sweat despite the below-freezing temperatures. His hands and knees slightly shook, and he had developed a splitting headache from his blood pressure remaining persistently high for the last 4 hours. With each explosion, Muth's stomach tightened even more. Continued prayers exceeded for the next flak burst not to be for him or his crewmates. The high stress of passing through the third major flak field in one day was starting to weigh heavily on nearly every member of the Bull, not just Muth. Marshy, for example, had his eyes closed, trying to imagine himself back home and not crammed in the back of his flying fortress. Jack in the cockpit was trying to keep his nerves under control as well as his plane. A nearby flak burst sent shrapnel towards the Bull's port side, causing no noticeable damage, but the debris sounded like someone was throwing gravel against the plane's exterior. Then suddenly, the flak stopped. Everyone in the plane was relieved for a moment, but then their nerves were heightened again as the call came in.
Bandit spotted, 8 o'clock high.
Willie in his turret looked and saw the distant white contrails high above the formation. As the planes grew closer, Willie gave a confirmed count of 3 squadrons. Then another call came in from Tommy.
More bandits spotted, 5 o'clock low.
Tommy, crammed inside of his ball turret, watched as the incoming fighters drew closer, their camouflage making it hard to track with them against the French countryside that was plastered behind them. As Jack asked for confirmation that the planes that Tommy saw were indeed enemy planes, a call came in over the group channel that confirmed what Tommy saw.
Anyone see escorts?
Asked Mills.
They should be coming around soon. They're supposed to rendezvous with us after we got past the flak.
Reinhold explained.
Well, they need to hurry their asses up.
Mills commented. There was an eerie moment of stillness leading up to both groups attacking the formation.
Here they come! Fighters coming in, 6 o'clock high!
Willie called out, watching the fighters make their attacks on the bombers in Dog and Charlie group.
Well, their knights coming in, 4 o'clock low! Watch into the tail, they're coming right for us!
Tommy called in. Marshy, overwhelmed with anxiety and fear, aimed his guns downward and saw tracer rounds zipping past his position and Bob McGee's position before he ever saw a fighter. Within a mere second, a sight of a green camouflage ME-109 appeared in Marshy's sights, but disappeared before he had time to react. 3 other 109s also appeared, one of them landing a single shot in Bob McGee's radio compartment. Marshy attempted to fire at one of the banking fighters, but his efforts were in vain as the fighter disappeared from his sight.
109 coming in, 7 o'clock high,
called in Muth before he aimed his gun and began firing in its direction. Bullets zipped past the Bull, and seconds later the ME-109 did too.
Escort's coming in, 11 o'clock level,
Tarnaski called in.
109 coming in, 2 o'clock low, watch it,
called in Tommy. As he began firing upon the incoming fighter, the thunderous quake of his twin 50 calibers reverberated not just within the turret, but also his bones. Not long after, the escorts arrived and began attacking the incoming fighters, with their overwhelming numbers playing a vital role in their aerial supremacy with the formation. Over the next 2 minutes, only 3 more fighters made passing attacks on the formation, and only one of them came close to attacking the 300th. The call soon came in that the fighters were leaving, escorts claiming a total of 6 down enemy fighters. The men of the Bull attempted to relax, but they knew that there was still a lot of geography between them and home.
Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them, they're sponsoring us, so I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where 3 hosts, a theater director, a movie critic and a veteran come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable, and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect, perfect, perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close, check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Canto 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much.
Are you a fan of Snafu? Well, I have exciting news for you. Hi, I'm Seth Aaron, creator, writer, and producer of Snafu, and I'm thrilled to share Snafu's new merch store with you. Introducing the brand new Snafu Podcast merchandise collection, where you can now wear your love of aviation history and the Snafu Podcast with pride. From high-quality t-shirts that showcase the iconic loadable nose art to stylish accessories and even your very own loadable bomber jacket, there's a little something for everyone in our store. So go ahead and head over to www.snafupod.net and make your way over to the merch page and check it out for yourself. There will also be a link down in the show notes for you. Thank you guys for all of your much-needed support and feedback. It truly means the world to me. Now, enough with the interruptions. Let's get back to the podcast. An hour and 10 minutes had passed since the formation weathered the attacks from Flak and fighters. During this time, a small group of ME-110s attempted an attack on the rear of the formation before being succumbed by escort fighters. Approaching Thurlow, Jack strained to catch a glimpse of potentially seeing Parnell's plane below, but the altitude thwarted any definitive confirmation. As the 300th secured priority for landing amid nearly half a dozen emergency landings, the Bull descended for its landing, taxiing towards this designated spot. Jack felt a sting of dismay upon noticing Fenway Bombshell's absence, along with the vacant hardstands of Hailing Mary and Tailwinders. Exiting the plane, the crew lacked the energy or inclination to engage with the other airmen seeking the mission details. The loss of established crews like Hailing Mary had left many anxious to know their fate. Men like Mills, Beans, Muth, and Tommy navigated through the crowd, their faces displaying a mixture of anger, frustration, and grief. Some onlookers recognized their expressions and backed off, but others, oblivious to the grim news, persisted. Mills rebuked one of the persistent airmen, prompting the seasoned men to intervene. Inside the debriefing hut, Jack inquired about Parnell's crew at the intelligence table, receiving a negative response. As he rejoined his crew, his demeanor reflected exhaustion and despondency. Lighting a cigarette, Jack stood with his crew, silently observing the chaos around them. Turning to Marshy and Tommy, Jack began to instruct, "Tell them everything that you can about Fenway. Every detail, okay?" But in a moment of clarity, he corrected himself, realizing the insensitivity of signaling out Parnell's crew's fate amidst the losses of the day. You know, as you've done before and will do with the others that we lost today. Jack finished. Amidst these thoughts, the fate of Brolin and his crew weighed heavily on Jack's mind, followed by the reflections on Playboy and Paul and the rest of Tailwinders, now likely lost or captured. The concentration broke as their crew was called to a table, worn-out men recounting the day's events. In the midst of this, Jack noticed the boss enter the debriefing hut, his face bearing a mixture of guilt and shame. Locking eyes with Jack, they exchanged unspoken words. The boss seemed saddened by the dimming spark in Jack's eyes, while Jack harbored a mixture of resentment and bile due to lingering grudges. The boss, catching Jack's look, gradually fell into a false assumption that Jack comprehended the underlying significance of today. Shifting his gaze away, Jack recentered his attention on the ongoing debriefing, attempting to follow the discussion points as they were being raised by the men. As the conversation eventually veered towards Parnell and Fenway, Marshy and Tommy offered every detail they could recall. Their glances towards Jack carried an unspoken message, almost as though they were sharing their information directly with Jack, bypassing the intelligence officer. After the debriefing concluded, the men dispersed, each heading in their own direction. Beck, noticing the profound emotional burden visibly weighing down Jack, opted to stay close to him, sensing the heaviness with each step Jack took. To Beck's surprise, instead of heading towards the officers' club or the barracks, Jack walked in the direction of the airfield. Confused, Beck inquired about his destination, but Jack remained silent, striding forward. As Beck continued to walk alongside Jack, the boss emerged behind him, gently advising him to allow Jack some space to grieve. Understanding the boss's suggestion, Beck slowed his pace, giving Jack the solitude he seemingly needed. As Jack made his way towards the control tower, he couldn't shake the weight of the losses that he had endured and the connections that he had forged over the past 3 months. Men like Parnell held a place in Jack's heart that went deeper than just mere comradeship. Their bond was akin to that of blood brothers. Others like Hill House, Tango, Brolin, O'Brien, Coca, and Sheila felt more like cherished cousins or childhood companions, despite the brief duration of their friendship. And then there were those like Andy and Rosie, whose camaraderie had grown into something invaluable. The ache of loss wasn't limited to just those he flew with. Even the boss, whose relationship with Jack had deteriorated into a fragmented and distant state, left a hollow feeling of personal loss. The weary members of Lotta Bull trudged back to their hut, their fatigue palpable with every step. Marshy, utterly drained and spent, practically collapsed onto his bed, his body too exhausted to even complete cleaning up first. Willie, peeling off layer after layer of his flight gear, recoiled at the damp, fear-drenched sweat that had permeated his long johns, socks, and heated suit. The stench of stress hung heavy in the air. Beans and Mills, with their faces sunburned from enduring sub-zero temperatures and the relentless winds for over 6 hours, suddenly peeled off their flight clothes. Every moment seemed labored, their exhaustion etched into every line on their face. Muth, attempting to conceal the telltale tremor in his hands, methodically removed his flight boots and carefully hung up his flight attire. His mind, still reeling from the day's harrowing events, turned towards his flight jacket. Retrieving a letter that he had carried throughout the mission, he gingerly unfolded it, revealing the cherished picture of his wife. As his eyes fell upon her smiling face, a soft, sincere smile graced his own, seemingly providing solace amidst the turmoil. Tommy sat on his bunk, wrestling with the laces of his flight boots, his gaze fixed on Muth, who held the letter and picture, the tender affection for his wife and unborn child evident in his eyes. Witnessing Muth's deeply emotional connection made Tommy reflect on his own feelings for Betty. He remembered Muth stealing a moment to glance at the same letter and picture earlier during the assembly. The sight of such sincerity in someone as unflinching and resolute as Muth stirred a torrent of thoughts about Betty, amplifying the depth of his love for her. His rekindled connection with Betty had sparked a fire within him, a feeling that demanded immediate action. Tommy realized the urgency of expressing his feelings, knowing all too well that tomorrow was never guaranteed. About an hour and a half later, the boss made his way towards the control tower, spotting Jack still standing, his gaze fixed firmly on the horizon. The boss was reminded of the similar moment when he approached Parnell while waiting for Jack's return. Approaching Jack, the boss spoke up.
No word yet on Lieutenant Parnell and his crew, or Lieutenant Benjamin and his crew for that matter.
Jack remained silent, his attention seemingly lost in the distance.
Jack, I'm sorry about Parnell. I'm sorry for what happened today,
the boss offered. But Jack still remained unresponsive, as if unaware of the boss's presence.
Jack?
The boss tried again, calling out to him.
I heard you.
Jack finally responded, still fixated on the horizon.
Jack, listen. You could save your breath, Commander.
I don't want to hear it. Jack interrupted, his tone resolute.
Jack, I'm sorry.
The boss persisted.
Okay. Thanks,
Jack replied.
Jack,
the boss called out again.
Why did you come here?
Jack finally turning towards the boss. The boss noticed the redness in Jack's eyes from irritation, encircled by dark rings that accentuated his bloodshot appearance.
All I wanted to say was, I'm sorry,
the boss reiterated.
All right, you said that. Now go,
Jack responded, signaling an end to their conversation. Realizing that his attempts were futile, the boss turned away, leaving Jack to his solitary watch. As Jack stood, his gaze fixed on the empty and still expanse before him, memories flooded back. Vivid recollections of a pivotal moment that he had faced before. The memory was of when he was plunging himself towards the English Channel inside Bad Penny, his intention to end his own life by crashing into the sea. As Jack moved closer to the crashing waves, and amidst the aircraft's groans of agony from the strain, Jack's mind conjured an image of Parnell with a profound sense of disillusionment etched on his face upon hearing the news of Jack's demise. Since time and war had all but clouded Jack's memories of Marlene and his parents, Parnell was the last person that Jack could choose to live for. It was that image that caused Jack to pull out from his dive, and instead made a rough but successful ditch landing in the English Channel, within clear sights of an Allied patrol boat. Later that night, Jack made his way to the officers' club, seeking solace with a solitary drink. He sat alone, nursing his thoughts and drowning his sorrows until Ronnie came to his aid. With a silent understanding, Ronnie settled Jack's tab and guided him back to his hut. Arriving at Jack's hut, Ronnie gently assisted Jack to his bed. The emptiness of the room, once occupied by Brolin and the crew of Hailing Mary, cast a haunting pall over the atmosphere. Seeing Jack's distress, Reinhold and Beck, roused from their own rest, hurried to provide assistance, relieving Ronnie of his caretaking duties. In the dead of night, Beck was stirred from his sleep, startled by Ronnie's presence in their hut once again. Rubbing the remnants of sleep from his eyes, Beck listened intensely as Ronnie explained the unsettling absence of Jack while pointing to Jack's empty bed. Disoriented and concerned,
Beck swiftly dressed and followed Ronnie outside. As they stepped into the darkness, the somber atmosphere was disrupted by distant echoes of turmoil. The sounds grew louder as they navigated through the sleeping huts, murmurs and anguished shouts cutting through the night stillness. Ronnie led Beck behind the hut, guiding him towards the source of the commotion. In the shadowed space behind the hut, Beck found Jack, a silhouette against the starlight sky, consumed by an overwhelming cocktail of emotions. The profound sorrow deriving from Jack was palpable, mingling with the raw trance of intoxication. His voice, a shattered echo of its usual calm, was now strained with anguish as he begged the heavens with fervent shouts and heartfelt cries. Beck watched, his heart heavy, as Jack's grief and anger poured out in a fervent dialogue with the night sky. Intermittently, Jack's voice crackled with emotion, punctuating his desperate pleas with calls to Parnell, an absent friend whose name echoed through the darkness. The haunting tone of Jack's voice cut through the stillness, the anguish piercing the hearts of those who bore witness to his distress, leaving Beck and Ronnie grappling with the weight of their friend's torment.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Season 2 of Snafu. Please leave an honest review of our podcast if you haven't already on whatever podcast app you are currently listening on. If yours doesn't have a place to rate or comment, then leave us your thoughts on our Instagram or Facebook pages. Both links are down in the show notes. Snafu is produced by Canto 34 Studios and is written and narrated by me, Seth Walters. If you'd like to find out more about what Snafu is and what we're all about, please visit our website at www.snafupod.net, and there you will find out more information about the Men of the 8th Air Force and more about the podcast itself. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next time for another episode of Season 2 of Snafu.